Hello, my name is Stuart Miles and welcome to the Apocalypse Podcast. Mobile World Congress, the world's largest mobile phone-centric trade show, is back and on in full force this week. With plenty of announcements expected, we've already seen several companies go early with their announcements as they try to get ahead of the pack. One of those companies is Oppo, who this week announced its Find X5 range. And Apocalypse Cam Bunton has been following the news and even has one of the devices. And guess what? Is here to tell us more. Meanwhile, I've been talking to the CEO and co-founder of a company that can determine who you are by your voice and plans to help your digital assistant know that it's you talking, even in a crowded room or noisy environment. And then Cam, lucky boy, comes back again to talk about the Panasonic Lumix GH6 digital camera, the follow-up to the incredibly popular GH5. Can Panasonic improve what's already been a great camera, or is it a bit of a misfire this time around? Stay tuned to find out. But before we start talking cameras, Cam, can you tell us more about the Oppo Find X5 Pro launch?
I can. So it's the latest flagship phone from Oppo. In the past, the Find series, well, I say in the past, it was about 3 or 4 years ago. In the past, the Find series was sort of their innovative range where they tried new and unusual things, but now it's very much the standard ultra premium flagship phone. This is like the iPhone Pro Max or the Samsung Ultra. That's what this is to Oppo.
Right. And so what's exciting about it? What's groundbreaking? That this is obviously clearly a flagship play, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And one of the things that stands out is the use of the materials and the design. Like last year, they had glass on the back of the phone and it was one seamless piece of glass and it sort of curved up to this camera ramp or hump. And this year they've done the same, but they've done it with ceramic to go one better, which means it's more durable, more long-lasting, more scratch-resistant, and it looks pretty nice too.
And so that's obviously clearly a luxury play.
It is, yes.
And does it work?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, to look at, you can't really tell it's not glass, but it's kind of comforting to know that if you drop your phone or something scratches against it, it's not going to get as easily damaged as if it was just your standard glass phone. But a lot of the other specifications and features are pretty much standard for flagship phones these days.
And how does the new Oppo range sit within the sort of the current lineup? I know we've still got, at time of recording, we've still got more announcements to come from MWC itself. We've obviously had the Samsung Galaxy S22 launch. Does this sit fairly, you know, have they put out a good stall, or do you think it's going to be overtaken very quickly by others?
It could be. I think the challenge Oppo faces, and it's one that they've been facing for the past few years, is still just that awareness of their brand name. I think it's people are very familiar with Samsung now. They've been making flagship Android phones for, 10 years, 11 years, maybe 12. People are very, very familiar with Samsung. And Oppo is still a bit of an unknown entity. But in terms of design, I think they've got something here that's a bit different to everyone else, and so that will help them stand out from the pack, I think.
And really, that's just a case of just trying to throw money at marketing and advertising beyond the amount of money they've already thrown, sponsoring Wimbledon and things like that.
Yeah, and football clubs and all sorts. I think it's that brand recognition, isn't it? People need to know that their phones are good, which they are, but whether or not they're going to switch from their Samsungs is a different story entirely.
Now, the X5 Pro leads the pack. There are obviously others within the range. Is it the same specs but just slightly different, or does it kind of drop off quite quickly?
No, it does drop off a little bit. So there is the regular Find X5, which looks very similar to the X5 Pro, but it has glass on the back and it has a lower resolution display. And then the X5 Lite, which is basically your standard mid-range, bog-standard, affordable Android phone. But they charge you more for it than, say, OnePlus or Realme would, despite it being essentially the same device.
And are we expecting these out to be out pretty quickly?
Yeah, the release date, I believe, is March the 24th. The Find X5 Pro in the UK, at least, will be about £1,049 retail price. So that's pretty standard for your top-level flagship phones. And given the features it's got and the specifications, I think it's a fair price when you compare it to the likes of Samsung and Apple. But they'll be out in March.
Now, we're on the eve of MWC, so it would be remiss for me not to ask you. I know you're going out to the show. What are we looking forward to? Is there what's the thing that you're thinking, okay, this might change the landscape?
It's hard to know. At the moment, from what I know, it seems a lot of the phone launches at MWC are very much the mid-range market phones. I'm not sure if there are any big names coming out. So in terms of that, I don't think there's much to expect. I think companies have sort of moved more towards launching big products at their own events separate from MWC. Mm. So I think it'll be interesting to see if there is anything at all worth talking about.
Still to come, Cam returns to give us his verdict on the Panasonic Lumix GH6.
So in my mind, it's for me. It's all for me. No, it's for people like myself, I think, who film and want to make good-looking videos, don't have a huge budget to spend on really expensive full-frame cameras.
We've all been there, shouted an instruction at a smart speaker on the other side of the room, only for it to reply with something completely unrelated. Is it us that's speaking badly, or the digital assistant not being smart enough to understand? Add to that the want for us to have smart speakers understanding different people in the room, me over my wife, for example, and you can see there's still plenty of way to go for the underlying technology that powers it all. Audio software company Yobi is trying to bridge that gap with what it calls emotional intelligence, working to get our digital assistants to not only understand our words, but also our intent, mood, and even stress levels, stating that our voice print is even more individual to us than a fingerprint. Keen to find out more, I recently caught up with the founder, Ken Stutton, and I started by asking him to explain what the company actually does.
Well, Yobi is a software company that has harnessed the power of artificial intelligence to basically duplicate the human auditory system as it relates to voice. So that's just a fancy way of saying we have the ability to extract voice metadata. That means your biometrics, direction of arrival, and all the things associated with your voice from a high noise environment. So the applications for that, just to try to bring it into more of a consumer type of vernacular, is the ability for your, Siri to work in your car, or your smart television to hear you across the room with screaming kids, in-laws, dogs barking, and those type of things. And also to give it some intent, meaning we can pass on some information about who's actually talking. So if you have a profile associated with that device, we can pull that up using your voice. We can do some high-level sentiment analysis and emotion detection. And of course, traditional cleaning up of speech so you can translate that, or transcribe it rather, to a command. These are all the things that we enable devices to do in what we call everyday noisy environments.
And you talk about the nuances in human speech and almost the biometrics of determining who I am and stuff. How does it go about doing that? How does it say, oh, this is Stuart, he's at the other side of a cocktail party and he's clearly wanting to listen to me, to listen to something I'm saying?
Exactly, Stuart. So the human voice is as complex as the human fingerprint. There are a couple of things that make it extremely unique. You have physical cues, which are things like the length of my larynx or my tongue cavity or the size of my mouth, that are just really obviously unique to Ken and Ken's physiology. And then you have social cues, obviously, Stuart, I'm not speaking with an English accent. So the way that I say words like, let's say, Connecticut, because I'm from Connecticut, is different than someone else's way of saying Connecticut. So if you take those two different, fundamental formants, if you would, my physical, makeup, as well as my social cues, and you put that into a combination lock, the way that I speak and the tones that are coming out of my vocal cords are uniquely unique, lack of a better term, for Ken. And so as long as you can get a clean signal where you can actually see those nuances, it is, I don't want to say it's trivial, but it's very easy to tell people apart using voice biometrics. And we didn't invent this methodology. This is something that's been around for years. Our real value proposition to the equation is the ability to do it even though there's interfering noise in other background situations that make it difficult to extract that metadata.
And so how do you go about isolating the speakers? Because, I could say, all right, I've got biometrics of my voice. That's fine. We've worked that one out. But I could be in a crowded room, or there could be noise from, as you say, from a road, from the car. Now, if I'm trying to match against perhaps a car horn or something, then that's probably fairly easy because I don't sound like a car horn. But if I'm sounding like other voices in the room, is it just a case of working out each biometric and then saying, oh, that must be not, that can't be him. It's got to be that person instead.
And that's a great question. And the way I would frame it is back to the genesis of the technology, which is how does the human auditory system separate voices, right? And so we're using a lot of different tools in a cocktail party, which is the actual scientific term, is the cocktail party problem, to disseminate different voices. And we're using things like unique pitch. We're using things like range, because we know how far the person is. We're using things like direction of arrival. We know which direction a person is in. So we use all those tools to do the same thing. And it's not just looking at the biometric signature, because in a lot of situations, we don't have a preset signature. We just know that there's, like on this call, we know there's, you know, two people on the call. We don't know who those two people are. We just know they're different voices and they're coming from different angles and different tenors and different ranges if I'm in a live situation. So we use all those tools to extrapolate, well, who is the voice of interest and how do we separate that from other voices?
And do you need anything to, is this something you can just apply to current technologies? And I suppose the following question is that is it in a technology that we have access to already?
Well, yes. One of our larger clients, you have to be careful, are three-letter agencies in Washington, D.C. that like to listen to situations. So just put it that way. From a commercial application, there are some brands that use our technology as enablers that they, you know, white label our solution. So their, you know, technology tends to work a little more effectively in on the edge. But, you know, our real requirements are, you know, very similar to humans. We need two or more microphones, two or more inputs. And our solution is, you know, suited for those situations. So a lot like human hearing, two ears. We are effective and we're software based, right? So we don't have to have a dedicated device specifically for our solution. As long as we have access to two microphone inputs and we can download our solution or be part of your, you know, SDK stack or embedded, depends on the client's needs. We're pretty agnostic to the platform.
And presumably this technology is not something you just go, oh, I've got this idea. And then like a week later, it's in place. How long have you been working on doing this?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Stuart. And it's, you know, we've been working at this for at least 5 years. The beginning of the company, when I started the company, is around some IP that we discovered in a studio, broadcast studio. And we were working on a problem with autism and perception of frequencies. And our first focus was actually in music, but we were tracking the voice market. And so we applied some of our tools for biometric tracking. We applied some of our signal processing algorithms and some of that broadcast studio intellectual property and applied it to the voice space. And what we found was it was uniquely suited, that problem, meaning extracting voice, was uniquely suited for what our AI algorithms were capable of. And so, to your point, this is not traditionally, you know, something that, you know, you fall upon by, you know, trying to solve the problem. We ended up solving the problem by coming from a very different angle and pivoting the company to a place where we thought there was going to be applications. And we were just fortunate to have our technology start to mature at this, you know, I guess, renaissance of voice technologies. And as voice becomes a more ubiquitous type of interface, we find ourselves in a very enviable spot.
And that kind of leads me on. I mean, you know, we've had voice assistants on our personal devices for over a decade now, or coming up to a decade. Some have been super successful. Others have kind of are there, but not necessarily at the forefront of our minds. And a lot of the time we just use, you know, voice commands to say, well, turn this music on, pause that thing, send me a cooking timer. How do you think, or how important do you think voice is going to be in controlling our devices in the future?
Yeah, Stuart, I think part of the uptick is what's happening in the conversational AI domain, right? Where instead of just giving static voice commands, now you can actually have more of a conversational type of interface with your device. And if you're using some of the data associated with your usage, it becomes an interesting symbiotic relationship. We're talking with a few companies that basically prepare media for your consumption. So they have access to everything that you've consumed prior. They have access to your location. They have access to your preferences. And so, you know, imagine a world where the conversational AI in the back end can speak to you and then start to recommend content for you to watch or for you to listen to. And so we see that happening across a lot of different verticals, even in the smart home or IoT space where, you know, your home can start to suggest some of your normal cadence associated with your morning routine. But the real selling point of that, outside of just moving towards, you know, moving deeper, I guess, into an interface world, is the data associated with how you interface with that platform is as equally important to the customer or the brand as your ability to interface, right? So just think about, you know, all of the data Google gets with your keystrokes. Well, when you're speaking to a device, I can basically extrapolate the same type of data based on your queries, based on your usage. And I get a much better view of my customer by basically taking all the text associated with, you know, translating that speech to text on the device to understand more about how to basically influence better suggestions or influence, you know, maybe even purchasing power as far as, you know, what are you going to buy from my platform based on me being able to suggest things to you that are pertinent to your spending habits and your buying habits. So we see a lot of activity around using voice and voice interface also for data around the customer to basically help create a more symbiotic, you know, type of a conversation with the platform.
And it feels that, as I said, we're still on that journey, and it feels that, you know, some of the things you're talking about are still a fair way off. How fast do you think, and perhaps being able to use your technology to help our assistants understand us and hear us better, how fast do you think we'll start to envisage a world like that?
Yeah, I think very soon. If our time at CES, you know, 2 weeks ago is any indicator, I think it's sooner rather than later. One of the challenges isn't the back-end technology or the intelligence of the artificial intelligence platforms that crunch these numbers. It's really the simple problem of a garbage in, garbage out type of scenario, where if you cannot get the most robust and clean voice signal at inception, all of the data that happens after that is corroded. So it's really just the barrier of entry of dealing with the environmental challenges associated with capturing voice is one of the hurdles that we see in the marketplace. And so, like I was saying earlier, you know, we had a tremendous amount of interesting conversations at CES around use cases that I would have never thought of. But after, you know, talking to the brands that are pushing out these initiatives, you say, you know, that makes sense, specifically in a lot of areas where I would rather be using my hands for something else. And so a lot of those situations are also environments that are not quiet like your home. They're in noisy environments. So once you take out the barrier of being able to capture the cleanest voice possible to run your analytics on, it becomes an interesting conversation.
And do you think that's with the technology? I suppose the final question I have is, with the technology that you've developed so far, is that something that is continually improving? And how far do you think you are on the journey for your own product of getting to that element of removing the garbage to be able to process the garbage?
Yeah, we're pretty, you know, pretty bullish on what we can do in noisy environments. It's the foundation of our technology and our value proposition is dealing with the noise. So, you know, from that standpoint, we think that we're, you know, if it's just about cleaning up the signal, we're in a very strong position to be very aggressive about that from a market standpoint. I think the additional value in, to your point, your question about our maturity, is also giving the metadata associated with the voice. I think it's more than just cleaning up the voice. There's also this interesting relationship between the front end or the data I can extrapolate from the front end and working with conversational AI in the back end, where I can give precursors around who's talking. I can talk about the environment. I can give you direction of arrival. I can give you all these kind of nuanced cues about what's happening at the device level that you can use on the back end. And I think that's really where our growth is going to come as a company, is drilling down into some of the other metadata in voice. We are finding that the voice signal by itself has a tremendous amount of information that if you can extract it, can be extremely helpful for some of these platforms.
Panasonic has championed the Micro Four Thirds format for many years, growing its potential, increasing focusing on delivering high-capable videography tools for the quality-focused enthusiast. Since 2014, the company has been pushing the boundaries of what's possible, starting with 4K, for example, and moving on to support for other things. But does a new model make sense, given the GH5 M2 was released only 2 years ago? Apocalypse resident video man Cam Bunton has been using the new camera and is here to tell us more. So Cam, what's it like?
Well, in a word, it's fantastic. I think it stays true to what the GH series is all about, which is about giving you high-end performance for not too much money and in a relatively compact format.
And so what's probably, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, okay, I've got a GH5 or maybe a GH4, it's getting a bit beaten up, it's time to upgrade, what's the big sort of leap forwards here?
So the big leap forwards, it's as you said in the introduction, it's all about videography and those people who want the quality footage. And so all the big improvements are all to do with the bit rates and the resolutions and the frame rates that you can record with this camera. So for instance, if you remember the iPhone launch way back last year when they talked about Apple ProRes, this can film 5.7K Apple ProRes if you want it to, which will eat up your memory in no time whatsoever. But it's got these really high bitrate, high frame rate recordings. You can record 4K at up to 120 frames per second if you want to. Again, memory allowing and battery allowing. But the good thing about all of this is that it's completely unlimited recording. It'll record as long as you've got storage left on your card and as long as you have battery juice left in the battery. So you're not limited and it doesn't crop into the sensor like some of the older cameras did. It's just a very good, very high-end camera.
Yeah, because it's normally a case of these things, normally you get to a certain time frame or a certain memory storage and it just goes, yeah, thanks very much, you're done now. Cheers, and move on. So they've removed that issue. So do you think that's means that this opens up the potential massively for this camera to be used, you know, within documentary filmmaking or even Hollywood blockbusters?
Well, I mean, Hollywood blockbusters might be pushing it slightly. Documentaries for sure. The good thing about it is it can record in full Vlog, which is like a sort of grayscale, almost completely unsaturated profile of image that color correctors and color editors like to use because it gives them a completely blank slate. And because it's such high bitrate, you don't lose any color or data. And so for those kind of users, it's fantastic. And in a camera that costs about £2,000 for the body compared to some of the full frame stuff from Sony, it's very cheap.
And so who's this for? Who's going to buy this? It's not wanting to film little Johnny at the swing, is it?
No, this is... So in my mind, it's for me. It's all for me. No, it's for people like myself, I think, who film and want to make good-looking videos, don't have a huge budget to spend on really expensive full-frame cameras, but want that quality and don't want to be limited to the bit rates and the memory and the amount of time that you can record with. I think that's essentially who it's for. It's for those who want the quality without having to stump up like £5,000-6,000 for a camera.
So kind of effectively, therefore, you know, the advanced YouTuber that isn't just starting out necessarily, but wants to create great quality video.
Absolutely. And if it's anything like the GH4 or GH5, it could be a platform that they use for the next 3, 4, 5 years, and it will serve them well, even for that time.
Cool. And so I suppose the question is, this is obviously, you've had one. Yes. It's going back. How sad are you?
Very sad. I'm going back to my GH5 now, which is a few years old. But yeah, it's been a lovely camera to use. The only thing I would say that needs improving maybe is the autofocus. It's still not quite as quick as Sony, but on the whole, it's a fantastic camera.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, pip, pip.